let's see, 20 minutes here. I want to, let's see, could we have somebody turn out the lights here? We read through this about scourging, and I want to share a clip that I've alluded to from the movie The Passion of the Christ. Yeah, if you can plug that in. Thank you. Thank you, Bradley. I want to preface this a little bit. The movie The Passion of the Christ came out 10 to 15 years ago. Directed by Mel Gibson, a famous actor, a little past his prime now in terms of acting, although he is an excellent movie director. Mel Gibson from Australia, he's Catholic, kind of an odd branch of Catholicism that is somewhat mystic. He chose to direct this movie, again, 10 or 15 years ago, to reflect his faith and belief in and appreciation for the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And there are many movies about Christ's ministry that are somewhat hokey, unbelievable, not historically accurate, not geographically accurate, not clothing-wise accurate, things like that. The reason I'm showing this movie is because of the emotional power. I mean, I'm just showing about 5 minutes of it to capture the emotional power, which I think is done far better in this movie than anything else. There are weird things in the movie. I don't wholeheartedly endorse it, so don't take me wrong. There's some depictions of some kind of weird things in here. You'll see... you'll see a figure that appears partway through this clip dressed in black, a black hood, and it's an androgynous type figure there, and it's depicting Satan. And this figure isn't visible to the other characters in the movie, and Mel Gibson explained that he's depicting Satan here to show the power behind the scenes at work. As we've read, after Jesus gave Judas the piece of bread, Satan entered him. Satan is behind the scenes orchestrating events. So that's what Mel Gibson is depicting in here, this figure that nobody else can see, but he's there and he's very real. It's interesting, I had a couple of you question me about this during the breaks. Having seen the movie, and there's actually three people orchestrating these events. One is Satan, one is God the Father, and one is Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ, as we've talked about, is, you might say, manipulating events. That's manipulate has a bad connotation, and I don't mean it that way. He is orchestrating events. We read Matthew 23, where he just lays into the scribes and the Pharisees with a blistering attack. And he is kind of building up the hatred. We haven't covered this, we're skipping over it, but he overturns the tables of the money changers again and says, my Father's house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations, and you've made it a den of thieves. He's calling the Jerusalem priesthood a bunch of thieves. So he's manipulating, he's orchestrating events to lead up to this because he knows when and how he has to die. We've already read several prophecies that he has to be crucified. He's not going to die by stoning to death, which is fast, takes a few minutes and you're dead. No, he's crucified, which is horrible, a horrible way to die. He knows when he has to die. He has to die on Passover as the Passover lambs are being killed in the temple. And it's interesting, Josephus says the Passover lambs are slain at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. When does Jesus die? He dies at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. As a few hundred yards away, the lambs are being slain for the Passover in the temple. It's being worked out according to the plan from the foundation of the world. between God the Father and the one who became Jesus Christ, the Son, the Word, as we've talked about. So this is what is going on. And in this clip, you'll also see two women who show up. One is Mary, the mother of Jesus, depicted here. The other is Mary Magdalene. Another young guy shows up. He's John. He's a young guy, about 18, 19, something like that. This is obviously playing with the events for story flow and for emotional impact. So this, for instance, shows Mary there while her son is being scourged and shows John there as her son is being scourged. That obviously didn't happen. This would have taken place within a Roman military fortification, and they wouldn't have allowed others, other citizens, especially Jesus's mother and followers there. So that's in there for storytelling effect. So with those caveats, this is what scourging looked like. Okay, let's bring the lights back up. So I hardly know what to say after that, but again, I show that because it shows the price of sin. And that's the whole point. Sin exacts a horrible price. Not just this is a preliminary. It cost Jesus death by crucifixion, the most agonizing form of death, as far as I know, ever invented by the demented minds of human beings. And what you just saw on here was very real. That's what scourging was done. There are descriptions of it in Roman writings of the time. And as I mentioned, a lot of men died just from the scourging before they were crucified because of the blood loss, because of the absolute trauma and shock to the body. And just horrible thing. It was done with a scourge. They actually showed two things here. They showed beating with rods, which isn't specifically mentioned in the Gospels, but you see that with Paul a lot, that he refers to being beaten with rods. That was the first part. And then scourging after that, done with a whip with strands of leather about yay long, with pieces of metal and glass and bone embedded in it, that would do what is depicted here, would literally rip the flesh of the victim to shreds. And just very, very, very gruesome punishment by the Romans. That wasn't done with every prisoner, but if something were viewed as an especially heinous crime, that was the punishment. And it was obviously a major deterrent to rebelling against Rome there. So I wanted to show that because this shows far better than anything I could ever describe about this. Did want to help us visualize this, what it was like, exactly what he went through, because it's just impossible to put this, the power of this, into words. So any questions about that? We covered the beginning of Jesus Christ suffering with the scourging, and now we move to the crucifixion part and his death. I would like to approach it a little bit differently, though, this morning, from the standpoint that there is a prophecy that describes the crucifixion from Jesus Christ's perspective. With the Gospels, we have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John describing the events as they are being witnessed externally. However, there is a particular Bible prophecy that goes through what Jesus Christ is seeing, what he is feeling, what he is experiencing, the thoughts that are going through his mind as he is being crucified. And that's the angle I want to go through today. So we won't be using the harmony much, at least not initially. We'll be focusing on this particular prophecy. Not sure, maybe I should just set this up here on the lectern here. Let's try it that way. So what we'll do today to kind of set the stage for this, let's step back in time. Pretend we're in a time machine. We travel 2,000 miles back to the other side of the world. It's springtime of the year, much like it is outside here. We're outside the walls of Jerusalem, where people are streaming in from all over the countryside. Again, a million or more people who come to Jerusalem with excitement and enthusiasm because the Passover feast, one of the primary feasts of the year, is beginning. And we're outside the city walls on a road that enters one of the gates of the city. There are several different gates around the city, and thousands of people are going and coming at that time of year, and the city is jammed. But here outside the road, alongside the road, a horrible spectacle is taking place. Several men are being crucified. A crowd is gathering around. Some are priests, some are Sadducees, some are Pharisees. A small number are Roman soldiers who are the crucifixion detail, part of the crucifixion squad, and other soldiers are there to maintain order. And many people are just bystanders, seeing what is going on, why, trying to understand that. Some are women who are sobbing and crying at the spectacle that starts to unfold there. Although it's mid-afternoon, the sky is eerily dark, very dark, adding a surreal quality to the scene that is taking place. It's almost the ninth hour, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, time for the daily afternoon sacrifice at the temple. But it's also on this particular day the time when thousands of Passover lambs would begin to be slaughtered for the Passover that would be held later that evening. Of those men, three men being crucified, the one in the middle is in terrible shape. He's been scourged before crucifixion. His entire body is a bloody, shredded mess, and it's clear that he doesn't have long to live. Meanwhile, in the inner court of the temple, several hundred yards away, priests are very busy lining up the Passover lambs to be slaughtered very shortly. This sacrifice, it will begin and carry on for a number of hours. The priests are lining up the lambs for that to begin. And outside the city walls, the dying man in the middle summons some strength from deep within himself. And he cries out, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And over the coming minutes, he will utter several other things that will be heard and written down by the writers of the Gospels and preserved for us today. And he will end with the curious words, "It is finished. It is finished." So what's behind what takes place? What's behind those particular words, my God, why have you forsaken me, and it is finished? Now that I've set the stage and help us understand the setting for these events, let's pick up the story beginning in Matthew 27 and verses 45, 46. I'll project this for you on screen. Matthew 27, 45 and 46. It says, "Now from the sixth hour, which is noon," they're counting from sunrise, 6 a.m., "from the sixth hour until the ninth hour, there was darkness over all the land. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, 'Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani?' That means, 'My God, why have you forsaken me?'" The Jewish historian Josephus, whom I've mentioned a number of times, explicitly states that the lambs were slaughtered at the temple beginning at 3 p.m. at the ninth hour. And again, there is this puzzling and mysterious darkness that has suddenly enveloped the land, a darkness that is no doubt sent by God the Father to symbolize, to signify the darkness of the events that are taking place with the brutalization and the death of the Son of God. Matthew here, we see, records Jesus Christ's words in Hebrew and Aramaic. El, of course, as in Eli here, being one of the names or the titles of God, as you've no doubt covered. And then he translates them into Greek, from which they are translated into English for us as, my God, why have you forsaken me? Let's back up a little bit. Did Jesus Christ know what was going to happen to him? Yes, he clearly did. He's familiar with other prophecies such as this from Isaiah 53, verses 3 through 5. He is despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised and we did not esteem him. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement for our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. This is referring, of course, to things like the scourging that we've talked about here. The bruising, the stripes, and so on. Christ's death was part of the sacrifice for sin. He also had to suffer, as we see here, because both are part of the price of sin. Sin brings suffering, sin brings death. And he had to experience both of those, as we see here foretold by the prophet Isaiah. Many, many centuries previously. Let's notice some other verses from some of the other Gospels leading up to this time. Mark 10, verses 32 through 34. Now they were on the road going up to Jerusalem. Then he took the 12 aside and began to tell them the things that would happen to him. Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and to the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him to the Gentiles, the Romans. And they will mock him and scourge him and spit on him and kill him. And the third day he will rise again. So Jesus Christ here foretells exactly what is going to happen to him. He's going to be condemned to death, delivered to the Romans, mocked, scourged, spat on, and murdered. And then the third day he will rise again. These are very, very specific. Not long after this, he told them again what would happen. Matthew 26, verses 1 and 2. Now it came to pass, when Jesus had finished all these sayings, that he said to his disciples, this is right after the Olivet prophecy and the parables of the talents and the wise and foolish virgins that we talked about. So right after that, he finished these sayings and said to his disciples, you know that after 2 days is the Passover, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified. So here he specifically tells his disciples how he will die. He will die by crucifixion. And he also knows, since he is the fulfillment of all the millions of Passover lambs that have been slain for the last 15 centuries, he knows when he will die. On the Passover. And yet through this, and knowing that he could have escaped all of this at any time, I didn't mention this when we talked about his arrest at Gethsemane, but think about the conditions then. He's at Gethsemane, it's nighttime, there's a full moon with the Passover approaching. The roads that come up to the Mount of Olives head down to Jericho. The Judean wilderness is no more than a 10 to 15 minute walk from there. He could have very easily, incidentally, from Gethsemane, you can look up and you can see the Temple Mount. You can see the temple, this huge 15-story building standing up there. You can see the path. He could have looked across. It's about 300 to 400 yards to the Temple Mount from Gethsemane. He could have looked up and no doubt seen the torches, heard the clanking of the armor of the temple guard as they come to arrest him. He knows what's coming and can probably see them and hear them approaching, but he takes his fate. He accepts his fate. He knows this is how it has to be. Again, he could have very easily 10 or 15 minute walk or jog and disappeared into the Judean wilderness, which is where David hid out for so many years fleeing from Saul, and could have escaped that very easily, but he doesn't. He knows what has to happen. And he knows what is going to happen from these prophecies that we've covered here. So when Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Where do those words come from? They are actually a direct quote from Psalm 22. Psalm 22. My God, why have you forsaken me? You may want to turn there in your Bibles. We'll be following along through this and going through this psalm. This is a psalm of the Messiah, but specifically it is a psalm of what the Messiah would go through in his suffering and death for the sins of all mankind. Whereas the Gospels, again, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, give us an external view of the crucifixion, this is the crucifixion as viewed by Jesus Christ as he is going through it. And I'm giving you this because it gives us a different perspective, in my view, a much deeper perspective of exactly what he is thinking and feeling. It's a combination of prophecy, it's a combination of pleading, prayer, lament, and ends with great hope, as we'll see. So let's go through this, see what he is seeing, feel what he is feeling, and see why he uttered these words and several other sayings as he is being crucified and what that means for us today. I might point out also that Psalm 22 was one of the most popular psalms of that culture of that day. It is one that many people have memorized. As many of us today memorize Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters, and so on. Psalm 22 was kind of like that in their day. It was a favorite psalm. It was one that people would often recite as they were dying because of the thoughts that we'll go through in here. And keep in mind also as we quote, as we read through and explain Psalm 22, that Jesus understands that he is fulfilling this prophecy. It foretells the agony that he would experience, the mental, the physical, the emotional anguish, as well as the faith and the trust that he has in God the Father to ultimately deliver him and give him the victory. So let's begin reading through this now and see what it has to teach us about these things. So beginning again, Psalm 22, verse 1, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me and from the words of my groaning? And again, this is written by David about 1,000 years earlier. And like a number of the Psalms, it begins with this lament, very, very human feelings and emotions and cries and pleas to God. And that shows up quite often in the Psalms. And this is one reason why the Psalms appeal to so many people, because we can identify with things like this. We can identify with these deep emotions that people feel at times. And they accurately express that kind of thing and kind of capture our emotions and our thoughts when we are going through trials as well. And we see this emotion and deep feeling flowing out from David, and we also see it flowing out from Jesus Christ during this time. continuing in verse 2, let's see, let me bring this up. I'm going to skip through some material. Oh my God, I cry in the daytime, but you do not hear, and in the night season, and am not silent. Let's think about what Jesus has been experiencing. Did he cry out in the night? Well, the night before, where was he and what was he doing? He was in Gethsemane, in the olive grove there, going to God, his heavenly Father, and pleading three times if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. He was crying out in the night season, as it says here. Is he also crying out in the daytime? Well, now it's daytime. Now he is being crucified. Yes, he is crying out. This is expressing his crying out, what the words that we're reading right here. No doubt he's also cried out to God silently or openly as he goes through the different hearings, legal hearings that we've talked about being brought before Annas and Caiaphas, Herod Antipas, brought before Pilate, and so on, as he is being struck and beaten by the Roman soldiers and so on, and the temple police, as he is having nails driven through his hands and his feet. No doubt he has been crying out for hours at this point. Continuing, verse 3, we see his perspective as he cries out to God the Father, "But you, God, my Father, are holy, enthroned in the praises of Israel." So in spite of what he is going through, he knows that God is in charge and in control, just as he always is. And he remembers what has happened before with Israel's ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and others. "Our fathers trusted in you. They trusted and you delivered them. They cried to you and were delivered. They trusted in you and were not ashamed." So this is an expression of faith in God, that just as he has delivered Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, David, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Daniel, many others who trusted and believed in God, he knows that God is in charge and taking care of things. And Hebrews 11, of course, we know, tells us that these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but and they died regardless of whether God delivered them from those specific circumstances or not. But he knows that God is faithful, and God does what is best for his servants. And this is his attitude as he is going through this extremely excruciating trial of being crucified. Now we come to a very puzzling, unusual verse. "But I am a worm and no man, a reproach of men and despised by the people." Why would David write prophetically of the Messiah? Why would he describe him as a worm and no man? We would certainly never think of Jesus Christ as being a worm. But there's actually a fascinating story behind this, and this is why, again, it's important to understand the cultural background, this historical, the archaeological background of what's going on in the scriptures. This Hebrew word translated worm is in Hebrew, tola, T-O-W-L-A, you see it here on screen, which means worm or scarlet or crimson. Three different meanings: worm, scarlet, and crimson. Scarlet and crimson, you see the connection there. They're both basically describing the same color, this dark red, kind of a blood red there. But what connection would that have to do with a worm? What does that mean? Why is Jesus Christ referred to as a worm and no man? So what's the connection? Let's notice a passage that uses this particular word back in Exodus 25, verses 4 through 6. And this is talking about the construction of the tabernacle in the wilderness and the materials that are used for it. And it tells us, verse 4 of Exodus 25, "And Moses spoke to all the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, 'This is the thing which the Lord commanded, saying, take from among you an offering to the Lord. Whoever is of a willing heart, let him bring it as an offering to the Lord: gold, silver, and bronze, blue, purple, and scarlet," this word tola, which means scarlet or crimson, "fine linen, and goat's hair." So this is describing the materials being used for the tabernacle. The people are offering gold and silver and so on, no doubt from the items they had collected from the Egyptians as they were leaving Egypt. But what I want to point out here is that this word worm in Psalm 22 and this word translated scarlet here are the same Hebrew word, this word tola. But what's the connection? Well, the connection is the particular worm that is used here is we would think of it more as a grub, kind of larva type thing. And here's what it looks like. This is a photograph of this grub, this worm, Latin name Coccus alysus, and it is called the scarlet worm or the crimson worm. And again, here's what it looks like. In the ancient world, people used different natural dyes to color their clothing. You didn't have red wool off of a goat or off of a sheep. You didn't have blue wool. You didn't have green wool. No, you'd use natural things from the environment around you to dye the wool, the fabric, the linen, to color it. You would use things like different kinds of minerals, seashells. There's a particular type of seashell that was very rare. That would dye things purple. You'd use minerals, you'd use, in this case, what they would do is take these grubs and they would grind them up in a bowl to create this kind of a red pasty substance. And then they would mix that in with water to dilute it and immerse the cloth, the fabric in it, or the threads, and create red fabric, red strands of wool, as we see here. This is what it looks like in its raw form, and then braided into wool for creating clothing here. So this is what this grub is, the scarlet worm, this crimson worm is used for, and why it has this name, and its connection with red. So what does this have to do then with Jesus Christ? And him being called a worm. The answer is really pretty simple, and this is why I showed you the clip from yesterday, because what has happened to Jesus leading up to this point? He's been arrested, as we've talked about. He has been beaten, as we saw illustrated. He's been scourged. He has had a crown of thorns pressed down on his head, and head wounds, if you've ever experienced them, bleed profusely, as his no doubt did. He has been scourged and his flesh is literally ripped to shreds. So what color is he as he is being crucified? He is blood red all over because he's covered with blood. And he looks, frankly, more like this grub than a human being. He's the color of this grub, blood red. He is scarlet from all the dried blood and the fresh blood that is oozing out of the wounds all over his body. He looks more like a worm than a human being. And that is why it says here in Psalm 22, I am a worm and no man, a reproach of men and despised by the people. It's graphic, it's disgusting, it's horrifying, but it's the reality of what he was experiencing. Taking on himself the penalty that we deserved for our sins. Continuing in verse 7, the next verse, all those who see me ridicule me. They shoot out the lip, they shake the head, saying, he trusted in the Lord, let him rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. Do these words sound familiar? Well, they should, because we see this repeated in Matthew 27, verses 41 and 43. Likewise, the chief priests also, mocking with the scribes and elders, said, he trusted in God, let him deliver him. Now, if he will have him, for he said, I am the Son of God. So it's fascinating. These same words that were written down by David about 1,000 years previously were now uttered at the crucifixion of Jesus Christ as he is dying. This is just amazing and incredible. that the very words that would be used, and Matthew clearly recognizes this and picks up on it and uses the same words here. Continuing in verse 9 of Psalm 22, "But you, Father, are he who took me out of the womb. You made me trust while on my mother's breasts. I was cast upon you from birth. From my mother's womb, you have been my God." And of course, as we've covered previously in the class, Jesus was divinely and miraculously conceived by God through the Holy Spirit in Mary's womb, even though she was a virgin. And God was working with him from birth throughout his childhood, throughout his entire life up to this point. So he has been the Son of God from birth. From my mother's womb, from the day I was born, even before that, you were my God. You have been my God. I want to consider something here that a number of scholars have come to a conclusion, and I think this is what is going on. As Jesus is hanging there, are these words coming to his mind? Of course, as we've talked about, he's memorized the entirety of the Old Testament. He knows it. He inspired it. He inspired David to write these words 1,000 years previously. Is he reciting this psalm as he is being crucified? His opening words, my God, why have you forsaken me, are Psalm 1, first verse of this psalm. Is he perhaps whispering this psalm as he is dying? Is he calling on his Father for encouragement through the words of this? Is he thinking of the words of this psalm as he is dying, as he's being crucified? Think about these words in light of John 19, verses 26 and 27. Okay, let's break.